on This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the 2013 Enterprise Wrap-Up. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 73, recorded December 30th, 2013. The 2013 Enterprise Wrap-Up. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Vallisere, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you by myself. I'm joined by my cast of characters, my cohorts, my good geeks in arms, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, how is the geek in paradise?
Oh, the geek in paradise is having a great time setting up a temporary mount so that we can broadcast HD video of Waikiki during the New Year's show.
I like it. Yeah, we're going to be showing you live what goes on over Waikiki when we hit that time zone. Now, in a completely different time zone, actually six time zones away, is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, how are things over on the right coast?
Padre, we've got a slightly cool but absolutely lovely midwinter day here in Florida. It's cool, sunny. The tourists are at the beach, and I'm here in the swamp having fun with Twyatt.
Indeed, and I always have fun with the two of you, which actually brings me to the purpose of this show. You see, we've hit the end of our first full year of Twyatt. Now, you may remember we started way back last year in July, but this was our first run through an entire year of enterprise news. And let me tell you, it's been a heady one. So what we'd like to do over the next couple of minutes is just go over our picks for the top news stories of the world. Brian, Curtis, are you guys okay with that?
Oh,
absolutely.
Fun. All right, let's hit it. Okay. You know, normally you want to bury the lead. You want to put it a little bit far back to make people keep watching, but we're going to start with it because it's so important. It actually touches all the other major stories of the year, and that of course is the NSA. But not just the NSA. I want to call this the year of the digital seizure. You see, we here on Twyatt, we're talking about government-related seizure of data way back in January of 2013. You may remember that we started talking about the South Carolina Supreme Court decision in the Jennings versus Jennings case. That was a really bad breakup, a marriage that had gone wrong, and essentially someone had hacked the other person's email to find out that he was cheating. Now, the Supreme Court mentioned Jennings versus Jennings as the basis for allowing abandoned, quote-unquote, abandoned emails to be read into evidence. Essentially, they were following up on the 1986 Computer Security Act, which stated that once you've opened an email, at least this was the interpretation, once you've opened an email and left it on a public server, a cloud server, it was no longer protected by the Fourth Amendment. Chibert, do you remember this case? Do you remember what we were talking about when we started going over it? Because I remember it brought up a lot of security implications.
Oh, yeah. This is actually one of my epic rants. The whole thing is kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth, shall we say. I'm opening my email. Does that mean anyone can go and grab it? Do I have no expectation of privacy in my inbox? That's pretty much the basis of what everybody's talking about here. And I've got some problems with that. And that's why I'm going to hold off on another rant, but this is where I really started ranting about, courts, do you really have your head on straight? You know, are we even doing any kind of common sense when applied to these laws?
Right, right. Curtis, I want to throw over to you because at the time We were worried about the implications for cloud-based computing. If the Stored Communications Act could be used to say that these emails were abandoned and therefore not protected under the Fourth Amendment, we started wondering, well, why would you put your business in the cloud? Why would you put your sensitive data in the cloud? And in fact, the very next week, the second week of January, we got a story from the EFF that talked about how the United States government had argued in their DOJ filing against Mega Upload that data in the cloud does not belong to its users. You may remember this case. It involved Kyle Goodwin, who had his data seized when the Mega Upload servers were seized. The government went through Mr. Goodwin's data without a warrant and then stated that they required third parties to travel to the United States through a lengthy process to get their property back. In other words, the United States government was saying, we could seize your data, and if you want it back, it's on you to do all the steps you need to do, potentially impossible, to get that data back. Now, I remember, Curtis, at the time, you saw this as a horrible, horrible trend because essentially the United States government was saying you don't own anything you put in the cloud.
Right. And this goes back to the whole notion of whether you cede all control over a thing, whether it's a physical thing or a digital thing, when you let it be stored by another, by a third party. And I've seen some interesting cases because on the one hand, this went back and the court ruled based on some old cases that essentially revolved around whether you still owned something and had an expectation of privacy when you threw it away, when it was sitting in the garbage can out by your street. But a lot of other people have said, no, that's really a bad analogy. A better one is what goes on inside a safe deposit box in a bank. Now, in that case, you've taken something and allowed a third party to hold it, but there is absolutely the expectation of privacy and security. So is a mail server a digital version of the trash can that goes out at the street or a safe deposit box? Obviously, law enforcement is arguing that it is, in fact, the digital dumpster, if you will, while most individuals and businesses think of it as being much more like the safe deposit box. Yeah. I think this is the basic definition issue that's going to keep driving cases. We haven't nearly seen the end of this.
Right. January and February were filled with a few other stories, including the DHS saying that it was okay to have suspicionless seizure of electronic gadgets at the border. You may remember that case of a teacher, professor, coming back in after a visit to the Middle East for research, and his computer was taken. No explanation, no nothing, just we're going to take this and we're going to examine it. Now, it wasn't all bad news at the beginning of the year. At that time, Google came out and they said no to warrantless cloud searches. They ran counter to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. That was the specific interpretation of the SCA, the 1986 Stored Communications Act, that said that emails could be abandoned and therefore could be searched through without a warrant. Google said, no, wait a minute. We demand probable cause before we turn over any data. In other words, we want a court order. We want a warrant. We want you to actually go through the system of search and seizure before we give our users private data. At the time, it looked like Google was fighting a losing battle, but of course, we didn't really understand why. Now, let's fast forward. April, we're talking here in April on Twiot, and we hear a little bit of a story. It actually almost ran right through our Enterprise Bite about Obama threatening the veto of CISPA. Now, CISPA, as we knew at that time, was an act that allowed the United States government to contact corporations and ask them for data on users. In other words, they wanted to use the corporations of the United States as a big, big data factory. Now, it was kind of weird because we weren't really sure why Obama was threatening to veto this, especially since it didn't seem like the consumers cared. We figured, well, if the corporations have our data, of course we think the government's going to have our data. So that was in April. In June, I think it became a bit more interesting. That's when Snowden made his revelations about the NSA, and the CISPA thing suddenly made sense. Because now we realized, well, of course Obama tried to veto CISPA because they were already doing it. Now, Chibert, let me throw this to you. It seems kind of weird that the Obama administration would have threatened to veto CISPA when it would have legalized what the NSA was trying to do with corporations.
Legal, yeah. But, you know, you got to start putting it in perspective, you know, you don't want to turn over too many rocks. If you start shining lights under rocks, you know, like CISPA and so forth, they didn't, you know, obviously Obama didn't know that Snowden was going to make this release. And he didn't want to shine any light at all under those rocks. So it still makes sense. And it still makes sense why Obama would have been playing with CISPA, because he doesn't want to shine the light. And most importantly, he didn't want to accidentally create any kind of precedence that would hamper the NSA's efforts. Because you got to remember, the NSA needs to be able to go in and needs to be covert for them to be effective. Now, all of a sudden, the light gets flicked on in the room, so to speak, with Snowden. The roaches start scrambling for cover. Sorry, NSA. And now, all of a sudden, everybody's got the NSA and this entire thing under the microscope, just like we've been doing for the last half of the year. So it still makes sense from a operational standpoint. It's just kind of not something everybody really wants. You know, just like Bartman just mentioned in the chat room, it's really starting to feel like what the KGB started to pull. And, you know, President Obama, I know you're my classmate, but bad, bad, bad.
Okay. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you for a second, because as we know, most of us know about the NSA story, about all the different revelations there have been. We know that the NSA built a brand new data center in Utah that cost $2 billion plus. We know that it has 1 million square feet. We know that they really built up this data center, that it's been having issues. We know that the FISA courts have been used to grant basically carte blanche for the capture of metadata. We know that the NSA has reportedly compromised over 50,000 computer networks across the world. Is there really a bigger story for the enterprise than this? I think this dichotomy is interesting between what consumers thought and what enterprise folk thought, because enterprise folk, I believe most of us said, well, of course this is happening. If I can monitor this kind of traffic in my network, of course the government's going to do it on the large telco networks. Whereas the consumers were saying, wait a minute, my traffic's being looked at. Is this really the story of the year?
Well, I think it has to be the story of the year because, as you said earlier, it really does have an impact on virtually everything we're talking about. Because after the revelations of Snowden, there really isn't anything that's happening in terms of the internet, in terms of data analysis, in terms of storage or transmission of private information that isn't seen in the light of that revelation. We now are routinely asking the question about just about everything that happens. Am I the only one who's seeing this? Is my company the only one that has access to this? To me, one of the fascinating things is that this has brought the questions that surround privacy and security that enterprises had not wanted to answer about their customers, to the point that enterprises are now asking the question of government agencies. It puts the enterprise in a fascinating middle position. And I really do think that it is, on both a philosophical and an operational level, changing a lot of what's going on around security and privacy procedures within the enterprise.
Chiebert, I love what Curtis is saying about how it's making people take a second look, a closer look of what's going on, of how their data gets used, of where it goes. But let me throw it over to you. The same question, which is, do you think the world now looks more at security like the enterprise has looked at security forever? There are things that the guys in the chat room, I mean, we've got some really, really smart people in our chat room. I'd say the smartest IT chat room in the world. And we're always talking about encrypt everything. We're always talking about secure your network. We're always talking about check at the perimeter and within your own local network. It seems like these are actually things that are becoming part of the common lexicon. It's not just for IT geeks anymore.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. You know, I really and truly am against what Snowden did to us. He has done more to cripple U.S. intelligence than just about any other person. He is definitely, in my book, a traitor. But I will say that some of the results have been good. There's been a lot of, shall we say, too many people are just saying, oh, it's good enough. And when you start getting demonstrations by Raphael Mudge on things that people that can get through your firewalls can get through and infect your network and hide what they're doing, we need to pay a lot more attention to security in general. And unlike HIPAA and unlike Sarbox, those were annoyances. It forced people to do things, but they were annoyances, and they did only what they really needed to do. What Snowden's effect has done, though, is it scared the pants off corporate America and said, we really got to start making this part of our main line of business. We've got to stop treating it as a tack on to our policies and make it part of our corporate structure. So that, I think, Mr. Snowden succeeded in getting America to go and pay attention. But dang, that was a really bad way of doing it.
Yeah, I like it. We're not going to debate whether or not people like him, love him, hate him, hero, devil, whatever it's going to be. But we will move on to something that is definitely part of the NSA story. Curtis, you picked, your pick for story of the year was the rise of metadata. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think when we talk about metadata, basically we're talking about the data about data. And this is something that most people had no clear idea existed. I mean, on one level, sure, if you'd ask them to think about it for a few minutes, they would come up with the fact that there would have to be some switching information that went on around phone calls. And they know that the caller ID is available and that there has to be data associated with that. But really, they had no clue that any of that was more than simply ephemeral switching information. The notion that metadata, the data about the communications that are going on between them and companies, them and their friends, them and their family, them and everyone in the world, that was something people didn't think of. And that was the huge revelation that came out of Lethard Snowden, that metadata exists, it's important, and no matter how much of it exists about your communications, no one is willing to say that it belongs to you. We've talked about HIPAA, your private information concerning your healthcare belongs to you. We've talked about your banking information belonging to you. But here, the information about your communications, by law, doesn't belong to you, and as a part of practice, is being scanned constantly by government entities. That's huge, whether you're an organization, an enterprise, or an individual. That's why I think that metadata, something that most people didn't think existed this time last year, is the story of the year.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those hot button issues. Metadata is, you know, we know that it's the headers, it's the phone numbers. It's not complete conversations, but it's a recording of who you actually talk to. You may remember back in 2006, AOL actually dropped a metadata bomb. It was a big data bomb that they got in trouble for. They changed usernames for a big dump of data, but people were able to reconstruct who those users were by the metadata, by looking at the searches, by looking at the activity. This was, you know, the first real brush with using large chunks of data to do something and also having it abused. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because, of course, when we think of metadata, we're going to think about the NSA spying, but that's not the only place that metadata has been used. If you were going to call this the rise of metadata, you could also call it the rise of big data. And big data has been used. We've been talking about it last year, this year, February, January. For example, about Netflix, how Netflix every day gets data on 30 million plays, 3 million searches, 4 million ratings, 2 billion hours of streaming video per quarter, time of day, abandoned plays, etc., etc., etc. That's just one company that's using those pieces of metadata to guide what they do and how they shape their business. Metadata is not exclusive to the NSA, But why is it that we think that for some reason the metadata they capture is different than the metadata that Netflix or Google or Yahoo captures?
And see, that's the issue. It really isn't that much different. You know, if you look at any major court case, a lot of it's all about patterns. You know, what has the bad guys done? How do they travel around town? How do we track them? How do we look at their finances? You know, remember, a lot of the organized crime, we got them on tax evasion, and that's all about searching for patterns. Now, as far as Netflix and all those folks go, this has been happening forever and ever. Has anyone remembered the Nielsen family? You know, Nielsen would have loved to have been able to do the same kind of tracking that Netflix has done. They just got there first, and, you know, it used to be a little notebook that you had to scribble in. You know, that's the whole issue. We're always collecting metadata. We're always collecting patterns. Heck, you know, walk into a supermarket. The things that end up right next to the checkout stand, those are spur-of-the-moment impulse item buys. How do you think the supermarkets figured that out? They're looking at different types of metadata. How are you buying? What are you buying? When are you buying it? Who are you buying it for? Why do you think you get coupons? You know, if you went and bought a whole bunch of diapers for a friend, why do you think the next time you go through the checkout stand, you're going to get some discount coupons for Pampers? We're collecting metadata all the time. The U.S. government, we just feel that the U.S. government shouldn't be doing this because we inherently like our privacy. But the whole issue is we have to strike a balance. We give up a few of our rights. We give up a little bit of our privacy because we believe we live in the best place in the world. And to protect that, we'd very much like to avoid having another set of jets flying into one of our big buildings. The U.S. government's not going to be able to do that unless they collect metadata. They need to find patterns, and they need to find patterns beyond just who's buying fertilizer.
And we've got a couple of good comments in the chat room from Web6292, who says, the interpretation of metadata from Netflix will not put you on a watch list. And also from Web7246, who says, the issue about metadata is those who sift through it can find wrong patterns, and that kind of freaks people out. We actually did cover a story back in April about how big data had led to the wrong conclusions about cell phone patterns, how sometimes you can have a big data sample set that is going to drive you to the wrong conclusion because you've already tried to get data about that conclusion. But I want to throw over to you, Curtis, because when we talk about metadata, I think what it comes down for me and what it comes down to for a lot of people in the chat room is we know that it's being gathered, and we know that the metadata that companies like Facebook and Twitter and Microsoft have about us is probably even more expansive and more useful than the metadata that the government's been able to gather through logging the headers of my emails or my phone calls. My question to you is, what if, totally hypothetical, the NSA were to disband and the government just says, okay, we're going to buy our big data just like every other corporation on this planet. We're just going to use it for a different interpretation. Do you think that makes it better? Do you think that makes it worse? It sounds like people are willing to give up the kind of information to corporations that they won't give up to the government, just thinking that somehow there's a difference.
Well, I think there are a couple of things in the question that you ask, and they're important. One of them is that when people give up their data, they feel that they are explicitly trading it. Even if people don't, as a matter of course, read all the terms and conditions for the services they sign up for and the products they buy, they exist. And so they feel that they have traded something tangible, their privacy information, for something tangible, a game, a service, storage, some product in return. What happened with the NSA is twofold. One, they weren't asked. Now, you can make the claim that they were, in fact, asked through their legislative representatives, but they weren't individually asked. And I think this is even more important. They don't feel that there was a direct trade of good for their privacy information. Now, Cheebert makes a great point. The fact that we have not had a repeat of planes flying into buildings could be seen as what was traded for the privacy. That's a huge debate, and one that we probably don't need to have right here. But the fact that you didn't have that explicit statement matters. Now, in terms of buying the data, I think that people might have seen it differently because at some point, someone did ask them about it, did get their permission, and did give them something tangible in return. All of that would have mattered. The thing that really starts to get to people, though, is that in the same way that they know they can get questions answered on the internet in ways that they couldn't answer them easily at the public library 2 decades ago, they know that the government and enterprises as well can do far more with metadata analysis than they could do 10 years ago. The picture that they can paint of the individual behavior is far more complete now than it was before big data techniques came on the scene. Put it all together, and it just makes people uncomfortable, as though the watchers are sitting far too close and seeing far too much.
I like that, Curtis. You know, I think one of the things about this story that scares us the most is we're starting to realize that the intelligence gathering capability that used to be reserved to governments and government agencies is now freely available in open source software. I mean, you can download Hadoop and you can get data sets by purchasing them from hospitals and retail chains. And you can do things with that data that people would prefer that you not do. But Cheebert, let me play devil's advocate. Let me stir it a little bit more and throw it back at you. What about the person who says, wait a minute. When I give my data to a corporation, it's because I know I'm trading that for someone else, for something else, another service. Or as Beatmaster in the chat room says, look, some people don't even know really what they're giving to corporation. But when it's my government, I demand that they go through the checks and balances. I demand they get a warrant. I demand they do the right thing. They follow my constitutional rights in order to obtain that data. It doesn't matter what the corporations are doing. It only matters what my government is doing on my behalf. What would you say to that person? How would you explain to them what you believe is data out in the open?
Well, we've been doing this for a long time. You cannot make an international call and not have at least the numbers you're calling and the duration, you know, the ANI records. You cannot have that not monitored unless you're perhaps using a sat phone or something like that. The issue is, freedom is not free. It takes work, it takes time, it takes effort. I would much rather put a little bit of trust in my government and trust that they do have checks and balances and hope, for God's sake, that some idiot doesn't abuse that right. The amount of checks and balances I had to go through to work with data that would perhaps be considered private data to some people. I had an annual IRS audit, and I had random polygraph tests all the time because my government said, we're going to trust but confirm. Are you living beyond your means? Are you perhaps turning the corner on abusing your power? There's a lot of that going on in the government. I would trust that process more than I would trust a corporation that's driven by profit. And, you know, I'm sorry, you know, people don't like that attitude, but that's the what I stand by. I have been in that community, and I trust that community a whole heck of a lot more than I trust a for-profit corporation.
Yeah. You know, if only Twit had a sponsor who might possibly help us with these issues. Well, we can dream. But until then, let's go on to what I found to be the next big story. And that's the rise, and I'm going to call it the fall, of the patent troll. Now, we covered this extensively throughout the year. I counted up. There were no fewer than 22 episodes that in some way, shape, or form talked a little bit about the trolling that's going on in the enterprise, trolling that's going on in IP tech. Now, specifically, we're going to talk about the non-practicing entity. There was a study that we brought up quite a bit, actually. We brought it up six times. That was the Boston University study that found that non-practicing entities, a.k.a. patent trolls, now these are the entities that buy IP, that don't intend to make anything, that only sue other corporations, other companies with the IP that they buy, that they cost $29 billion at minimum. That was the 2011 number. It's gone up considerably since then. That study was authored by Professor Michael J. Murr and lecturer James Bessin. Their work has been used by the FTC, by the European Parliament, by the U.S. Supreme Court, by the Federal Circuit Courts, and by the Federal Trade Commission. That's up from $7 billion in 2005. And in fact, a preliminary study shows that in 2013, we could actually be getting up in the over $100 billion a year realm once you factor in lost product cycles and wasted productivity. So this is a serious problem, and we've seen it rear its ugly head throughout the year. Red Hat got sued, Rackspace got sued by Unilock and was defended by Red Hat. We saw Microsoft and Apple go after Google. We saw Apple go after Google. We saw a lot of different companies make file lawsuits in Texas, knowing that Texas was a very patent troll friendly state. And we've seen a couple of moves by Google and by Microsoft and by Red Hat to do sort of assurance packs where they say, if you use our products and you get sued, we'll come and defend you. Now, we've also seen moves by the United States government, specifically by Vermont, that came up with the nation's first anti-troll bill, and later by the Obama administration, which proposed a federal bill to stop patent trolls. Now, Cheever, I know that you have no strong feelings about patent trolls, but do you want to maybe talk a little bit about patent trolls during 2013?
Oh, patent trolls should all die.
And there's our showtime.
Yeah, there it goes. No, this is unfair. You know, I really and truly hate people that are going and fishing for patents on something that's been around for a while, you know. My favorite, the one that'll set me off every time, is how Verizon went and patented using digital voice, you know, voice over IP for trunking. And it's like, come on, guys, that's been around. I remember typing up a report for the AlohaNet project talking about that very thing. And trust me, if I can ever find that particular passage and make copies from the federal document repository, I am going to make it my life's work to try and kill that patent. So Verizon, you're on notice. I am going to try and kill that patent because you are stealing someone else's work. And that's the bottom line. That's what patent trolls do. You are stealing someone else's work.
It's a good thing that you don't have any strong feelings on that, though, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't make. And I see you laughing over there, Mr. Franklin. Let me throw this over to you. We've seen a couple of moves late in the game, late in the year, specifically the Innovation Act, which passed the House by a vote of 325-9. By the way, you probably should look up which of your representatives voted against this, that looked at three specific parts, which actually were highlighted both in the Vermont bill and by the original bill that Obama talked about. That was allowing big companies to step in to fights. So, for example, if Company A sues Company B, and because Company B is using the software of Company X, Company X can step into that lawsuit and say, wait a minute, you're suing a little guy just to get precedent. We're going to step in to stop you in your tracks. The second part was that the plaintiff, the troll would have to pay court costs if the court determined that it was a patent troll, if they just did a shotgun lawsuit, which means that these non-practicing entities would be dissuaded from doing these sort of extortion lawsuits where they sue a dozen companies, 100 companies, 1,000 companies for just less what it would cost to defend yourself. And the third part was that discovery would be moved to after the examination of the patent claim. So rather than allowing a patent troll to indefinitely delay the trial of the merit of the patent, they would ask for discovery, and they would keep asking for discovery, using up the money of their patent troll victim until finally the patent troll victim threw up their arms. Curtis, when we talk about reforming the law to stop the patent trolls, I'm hopeful because I'd really like to stop hearing these stories in the new year. But is this just a cat and mouse game? I mean, it sounds good what they're trying to do, but patent trolls are going to be patent trolls, right? I mean, if you own that IP, you're going to find a way to get money out of it.
Well, I think that one of the keys is that what they're trying to do is sneak up on this. And you're right. There are very intelligent, very skilled attorneys who will work to keep the process of being a patent troll profitable for their clients. It's what they do. It is their professional responsibility to do that. And so I think this is going to be a multi-year thing. Now, I happen to think they're doing the right thing in attacking the methods of the patent trolls rather than the basis of the patents themselves. We've got some issues coming up with those when it applies to software patents and process patents, neither of which I think should be allowed. But for patents for tangible things, real inventions, what they're doing is still allowing inventors to sell the intellectual property that they have discovered. And that's critical for keeping the small inventor in the game. Without that possibility, then patents and development of new ideas become something that is economically viable only for the largest companies. We don't want that situation. We need the small inventors there. We still allow them to sell the rights to their invention to gain from it so that they can go out and invent something else. But we are trying to limit what the people who buy those patents can do with them. And I think that's the right approach. Is it solved? Absolutely not. I think we're still going to be talking about this and how we're getting closer, perhaps, in another 10 years. It's a problem that took a long time to develop. It's not going to go away overnight, no matter how good the intentions of the legislature and executive branches of the government.
Now, Chiebert, I know that you're fighting in the chat room right now in the previous big story about NSA spying, but I want to bring you into this for just a little bit because I think you could provide us with a unique perspective. And that is, we've got people in the chat room like Dudes Fritz who's saying this is just regulatory action for a flawed patent process, that the IP system itself is messed up. You've also got other people, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here, who say, wait a minute, you know, that line that we hear from patent trolls all the time that we're protecting innovation, we kind of gloss over it. But isn't it at least a little bit truth? If I, as an inventor, come up with a patent and I'm not able to fully capitalize on it because I lack the money or I lack the backing, and I sell it to a corporation who maybe then uses it to sue others, Isn't that okay? I mean, if I came up with a decent enough idea to make it that could be patented, shouldn't someone be able to pay me to take that idea and make money with it?
Yeah, it's just, I am not one that wants to be black or white. The world is gray, and there's always going to be some cases where I'm wrong or I'm on the other side of the opinion. You know, in the chat room, Tali is on one side, I'm on the other side. We're blasting back and forth. But the nice thing is about America is we are all entitled to our opinion. And just because you don't agree with me doesn't mean you're necessarily wrong. It just means I don't agree with you. Same thing goes for patent law. I think we need to strike a balance. I think the U.S. Patent Office needs to be shored up. I think they need more expert opinion. I think they need to pay more attention. And I think they need to work with Congress and actually revamp our patent laws, because our patent laws are right now too easy to abuse. So I think there needs to be balance. It's not black. It's not white. It's a shade of gray.
Shades of gray. Let's move on to the next big story, because I really like this one. It has very little to do with data collection or patent trolls. And that is your choice, Chiebert. the rise of the mobile platform. It's interesting that you would spot this in 2013 and not 2012. What makes this the year of the mobile platform?
Mobility, my personal opinion is, yeah, the mobility is great and all that. But this was the year that 40%, there was a 40% rise in the amount of things that were purchased online during Christmas. And personally, I think Christmas is one of those weird seasons. I love it dearly, but it is kind of strange in that most retailers will base their entire year's projections based on Christmas. So if they're doing that, maybe there's something to it. You know, there might be some trends that are falling, but with a 40% rise in purchases of Christmas gifts online on mobile devices, wow, that's pretty major. And I'm seeing a lot of people talking about new devices, new technology. We're starting to see people using more and more intelligent ways of moving data around on mobile devices. We're starting to see mobile devices become the front end to the cloud. Google Glass is probably a great example. There's a lot of hype around it, but Google Glass would not be able to do what it does without a heck of a lot of power on the back end. So mobility, people want to have their data where they are, not where they work. They want to be able to have it at all times. You know, I've now moved to a Nexus 7 with LTE because I didn't want to have to find a Wi-Fi hotspot. I want to be able to have data anywhere I go. And I think the U.S. public, and I think much of Europe, is also moving in that direction. And the data plans are starting to follow suit. The people are voting with their dollars. And mobility is now starting to outsell laptops. It's now starting to outsell some classes of desktops. It's getting to the point where people want to have the data where they are all the time.
I like that. Curtis, I want to throw over to you because there's an interesting point to be made here. Last year, we were talking all about BYOD. BYOD is the big thing. Every conference you went to, every enterprise conference, talked about BYOD, the challenges, the opportunities. Either how do you secure BYOD devices? How do you use BYOD devices to expand your vertical market? All those things were part of the enterprise equation. But I think Cheebert's onto something. If you look back and you see that the number of desktops has fallen. Even Apple desktops have gone down. Apple notebook sales have gone down. What has gone to the roof is the sale of mobile. And we are starting to see that as, BYOD is not really everything. BYOD is bringing in your phone, bringing in your tablet, and as Cheebert mentioned, getting access to all the data. My question to you is this. This rise of the mobile platform, this rise of the mobile device, this year of the mobile thing, is it really just the rise of a window into the dumb client era? You know, the little device that gives you access to your data and your services, which are stored in a place that's not on that data, that device.
Well, in many ways, I think you're absolutely right, Padre. What we're really talking about is the rise of multiple windows into enterprise data. The data matters. The applications to manipulate the data matters. What people want is the ability to manipulate that data and get at that data no matter where they are or when they need the data. They want to be able, and they'll tell you, to respond to customers anytime, anywhere. And as long as they make the case to executives that this is part of being a successful business, then executives will put pressure on IT to make it so. You know, to me, the fascinating thing is that while I absolutely agree with Brian that this is a huge thing, mobile is the big platform news in enterprise computing. It's incredible how quickly it's happened. You know, only about 3 or 4 years ago, we were still talking to companies about whether or not they would allow smartphones and tablets into the enterprise. And many of them wouldn't. They simply said, well, we're not going to do that. You don't hear those conversations anymore. It's the rarest of companies that can still say, we just don't do mobile. Now everyone's doing it. And the question is, how can their processes, their procedures, their policies keep up with the reality of this constant availability to information and the constant ability to interact with that information, no matter when and where that need is?
Chibert, let me throw that over to you. Curtis made that interesting statement of, you know, we just don't do mobile. That's the same as a company saying, yeah, we don't want to be in business anymore, right? Because contrary to what we thought at the beginning of the year, that first story that we covered about how we thought the application of the Stored Communications Act in that Jennings versus Jennings case where email could be abandoned and therefore looked through without a warrant, we thought that that was going to stifle the growth of the cloud, that we thought that would prevent people from putting their sensitive data. But with this rise of the mobile device, with this era of the mobile gadget, we've seen exactly the opposite, right? I mean, it seems people are now even more trusting, to the point where you've got companies like Google and Facebook and Yahoo who are saying they are now going to encrypt their data on all their servers within their data centers because they understand that that's how people access their data. They're no longer storing it on their local computers. They're storing it on their email server.
Yeah, so let's actually take a step back and put a lot of this stuff into perspective. We still need to make sure that our data is more secure. We need to encrypt more. But the market, remember how I'm always harping, vote with your dollars. And that's what the United States, that's what the world has been doing. They've been voting with their dollars. And the very fact of the matter is, it's not one thing or the other. It needs to all happen. You know, I've been bouncing back and forth with Tali in the chat room about, you know, this is right, that's right, so forth and so on. What is treason? What isn't treason? But the whole issue is there's a lot of different facets to this problem. It's not black or white. We need to secure our data better. We need to get our government to realize that, yeah, you went a little too far with search and seizure on data in the data center and unopened or open email being trash. No, come on, let's be reasonable. We need to speak up. We need to vote with our dollars. We need to call our representatives. We need to email our representatives. We need to have our voice. And I'm going to, you know, my year end thing is going to be, we live in America. Democracy is not an easy thing. You have to participate. You have to be part of the system. You can't just completely trust the people in power, but you have given them the power to do things on our behalf. And that includes things like data privacy. That includes things like protecting our markets so that our mobility can be ever increasing. It's all about being able to live in the best country on the face of the earth.
All right. I want to move on to the last story of our 2013 wrap-up. And this might be a little bit of fan service because, again, I'm very jealous of my fans. I'm jealously protective of my fans. I want to make sure that the people who watch the show, who watch us do this every year, understand that I think that you understand the world in a way that a lot of other people don't. And that's why I think this is the year of the data center. I know that's going to sound strange, but Chibert and Brian, hear me out. I think what we've seen this year in all of these stories, if we're talking about the NSA, if we're talking about patent trolling, if we're talking about mobile devices, we're talking about an increase in the exposure of what we would consider hardcore IT, the data center, data security, network privacy, and how it's now entering into the mind, the lexicon, the public understanding of what's important in this world. Let me flesh this out. Just this past year, from January to December, we've seen Google and Microsoft release containerized data centers that have actually made the public, the mainstream media, that people have actually been looking at and trying to understand what they do. We've seen super green data centers pop up from Microsoft and Facebook and Yahoo. We've seen technologies make the mainstream news that specifically talk about delivering data more quickly across the Pacific, across the Atlantic. And we have seen a lot of news about the NSA's data center learning curve, how their $2 billion data center was basically frying itself. What I want to get from you, and Curtis, I'm going to throw this over to you first. Are we now reaching that point where IT, where super nerdy IT, is going to be something that everyone who wants to participate in modern society is going to have to know? Are we yet at that point where everyone needs to know what good network security is, where everyone needs to know where their data is stored, where everyone needs to know how the cloud actually functions?
Well, I don't know that we're going to reach that point, because here's what I think we are coming closer to. If you think back to the 80s and 90s, in order to become part of the business conversation, you had to learn something about the language of the mergers and acquisitions business. You had to learn something about the language of the startups. And then in the early parts of this century, you had to know something about the language of, say, derivatives. Even if you didn't know how they were put together, even if you didn't know all the intricacies of the financial instruments or the financial transactions or the ways that they were accounted for by the CPAs, you had to know the language. You had to know the very broad concepts. I think we're getting to that point in enterprise IT. There are a lot of these hardcore IT concepts that you mentioned that people are going to have to know from a linguistic standpoint and from a broad familiarity. They're going to have to be able to at least give lip service to knowing what they're all about. Will they actually know what they mean from an operational standpoint? In many cases, no. Will they know how to manage them, how to request them in a way that is meaningful and doesn't end up stomping all over the rest of enterprise IT? Almost certainly not. We're seeing this already in the rise of what we're calling shadow IT. But the broad concepts are coming into everyday enterprise use. And I think that's a good thing, because it's putting IT on the same footing from an enterprise culture that finance, sales, and marketing have been on for the last 20, 50, or even 100 years.
Chibert, let me throw over to you. Not too long ago, I was at a family celebration, and I always get tech questions, but normally it's what phone should I get? What MacBook should I be looking at? What are the specs on the desktop computer for video editing? Blah, blah. Those are sort of the typical family tech problems. I was a little, amazed this year when it turned from what should I buy and where should I buy it from to people asking me how they could best secure their email, how they could encrypt the data that they put onto Dropbox. That's why I'm wondering, is this a slow transition? Are you seeing this at the university where even students who have no interest in tech now understand more about the IT world than they would have even a year ago?
Well, more importantly, the students are starting to be more aware of, gee, maybe I should make sure my laptop is on the lock screen, you know, password protect my screensaver. Maybe I should be using an encrypted hard drive to make sure that, you know, I don't start tracking malware into my home or into my working place. It's all about public awareness. You know, they're, you know, saying hi to CyberDog. I went to go and visit and do a lecture on fiber optics, how to terminate fiber optics for his class. It wasn't because I was expecting his students to be able to be fiber monkeys. No, it was because I wanted them to be more aware of the process, so that when they go into their day-to-day job, they'll be more aware of what's involved with it. You know, keep the contractors honest, be able to write intelligent specs. I think that's the change. A lot of the things that are happening in security are just raising awareness. I totally agree with Curtis that the IT world is changing, and our managers, our administrators, they need to be more aware of how things work. You can't just stick your head in the sand anymore. IT is woven through the very fabric of our society, and it is in our best interest to make sure that we understand it. And God, I wish people would get off those cheap freaking firewalls. My cousin had, I'm working on rebuilding my cousin's laptop because it got through one of those cheap firewalls, and wow, I'm thinking I may have to actually just scrub her machine down to the bits and start from scratch.
Well, gentlemen, there you have it. Those were the stories we picked as the top trends, the top stories, the top tidbits of 2013. Is there anything else you think we need to add to this? I mean, of course, the NSA story is big, and it kind of spiders through every other story. I think the patent troll stories are also very important. What we've done with big data and what we've done with mobile devices, as well as the public's understanding of what a data center and IT actually is. Is there something else that you can think of that 2013 really should be known as? I'm going to open question to both of you.
Crickets. Yeah, you know, this is a tough thing. But 2013 has certainly been an interesting year for me. It is changing the way the world looks at data. It's changing the way the world looks at cybersecurity. And my big parting shot for the year is, people, pay attention to where your data is. Pay attention to how you connect to the internet and work towards world peace.
World peace. I like that. Thank you, Chibert. Curtis, what would be your parting shot for 2013? Oh, you're muted.
That's probably the thing. Hey, you're muted. I can think of several small things that add up to a big impact. You know, we've moved past the point where we're talking about whether people should virtualize their infrastructure. And now we're having conversations about how best to virtualize. And it's infrastructure ranging from servers to storage to the network to the client. Everything is becoming software-defined and virtualized. That's been huge, but that's evolution, not revolution. Another thing that's becoming more and more important, you know, back 15 years ago, the fellow who was the head of MIT's lab, Nicholas Negroponte, the media lab at MIT, Nick Negroponte used to always say that it made much more sense to ship bits than atoms. And through the rise of things like 3D printing, we're beginning to see more and more the ability to ship atoms as bits. And I think that's something that is yet to be seen how it's going to work out, but the seed's been planted. Lots of seeds, lots of things growing to fruition, and I agree with Brian. You know, it's just a fascinating time to be in and around this industry because it's becoming more and more important from the NSA and metadata all the way down to a huge variety and power in the phone you can put in your mom's or your kids' hands. IT is everywhere, and boy, howdy, it's a good time to be alive.
It's a good time to be alive. Well, folks, that's it. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 NSA analysts. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible, starting with my host, Brian. You know, tell me what you're doing this year. Tell me what you're looking forward to in the next year. Tell me what the Twilight Riot should know about Chibert.
Chibert wants to finish his book on cloud security. My editors are screaming at me saying, where's the galley? Where's the draft? I'm thinking I'm going to try and work really hard and get a draft done by the new year. And I think I'm going to shift gears and start writing some fiction.
You know, if you're thinking about making the switch, we here at Twit have a group of people who are kind of diamond clubby who are good at crowdsourcing books. You may want to talk to them. Yeah. Okay, Curtis, how about you? What are you up to in the new year?
Well, since I'm the co-author of that book on cloud security, I think you've just heard a preview of how I'm going to be spending the next little bit of time. Working on that, moving on to other books, ideally with my my co-author Chiebert. It's a great thing to do, and I'm just looking forward to telling more stories about the interesting things happening and the interesting people doing them. You know, IT folks are doing some amazing things, and I just love being there telling the stories about them and talking with them, and I appreciate being here to give me yet another window into that fascinating world.
It absolutely is a fascinating world. And you know, on a personal note to both of you, to Curtis and to Chiebert, I want to say how much I've enjoyed doing This Week in Enterprise Tech with you this year. It's been a rush. In fact, the last 73 episodes have been an absolute rush. One of my favorite times of the week is when I get to sit down in front of a camera and talk to the two of you about the stuff that we're really, really passionate about. I wouldn't have nearly as much fun. It wouldn't be nearly as good of a show if I wasn't for the brain and the beauty of Curtis and Chiebert. And I'm going to let the two of you figure out which one is brain and which one is beauty. Yeah, we're going to leave that there. But you know what? Also, thank you to you. That's right. The person who has stuck around all year and downloaded our episodes, who has listened to us go through every little bit of minutia about IT. We do this show because of you, because you download us, because you watch us, because you watch us live, because you participate in the chat room. It's fun to do this show, which is why I think it shows through in the final product. And so I want to do something for you. Now, I know I talk about this and I'm surprised every time it happens, but seriously, please go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. There you will find all the different ways that you can get our episodes downloaded into your devices automatically. And it really helps us out. It helps us to figure out what are the topics that we should be covering, who are the guests that we should be inviting, what are the things that you like to see most. Vote with your downloads, and vote often, because it helps us to bring you the best dang enterprise IT show in the planet. Also, did you know that we've got a YouTube page? Yeah, you go to YouTube.com/twiet. Yeah, all those things. Put those all together with my words, and you will be able to find every single episode of the show in easy-to-view format. And starting in the new year, we're going to have Hangouts. And if you're not subscribed to that channel, you won't know when we're going to have them. If you think we're fun on the show, just wait till we get into a Google Hangout. Also, please follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/Padre. This is Twitter, right? Brian, how does Twitter work? Twitter.com/Padre Astray. Follow me on Twitter, and you'll be able to find out what the digital Jesuit does when he's not doing Twit or Twit-related activities, and you'll be able to suggest topics for future shows. Finally, please join us live. We have so much more fun with our audience when you're here. Every Monday, noon Pacific time, although in the new year, we're going to be switching to a different time, so don't listen to me, but join us anyways. Go to twit.tv/calendar. As long as you're watching live, jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You'll hear us calling out people from the chat room whenever you make insightful comments or whenever you call us on something that you think is wrong. It's part of the community that we've created here at Twit TV. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House who made this show possible. To Leo, to Lisa, to my excellent TD, Jason, to my temporary TD, and actually quite a good man, a good friend, Mr. Brian Burnett, the cranky hippo himself, to my super producer, Karsten, and of course, to every one of you who's listening right now. I'm Father Robert Ballas here at the end of 2013, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twit. This episode of Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Brian Burnett. When you need to shake it like a Burnett.
Shake it like a doge.
Shake it like a doge. Drop it like a doge. Drop it like a doge.